Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Utterly Unscripted. I'm Jesse Veritas, the host of the show. The point of this podcast is there is no point. It's just my friends and I getting together over a glass of our favorite beverage. Today, it's not my favorite, it's just water. I'm joined by Andy Fry, who wrote 90 Days in the 90s. Hi, Andy.
How's it going?
Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
Good to talk to you. It's my pleasure. You're all the way from Chicago, where it's, windy.
Today it's basically we've had Los Angeles weather for about the last 2 or 3 days. And a week ago, I wore a coat and it was 30 something and it didn't feel like I had a coat on. So it was one of those like, oh crap, it's like really that cold. So,
but I've been to Chicago one time ever. And I spent 4 hours there, and I regretted not spending longer, but that was all I had time. Actually in Chicago, and then I went out to McHenry, which is not in Chicago. So I was what? At the airport?
You were not at the airport then. You were actually on the ground.
I was on the ground, and then I took a car out to McHenry, and I went to Champaign, which is another place I spent some time, and drove from there down to Kansas just for something different.
Was this just your All-America tour, seeing boring Illinois and Kansas stuff, or what?
Well, so I lived in Louisiana for nearly 7 years, and so it was just visiting friends, and I just decided that maybe it would be interesting to drive from Chicago out to Kansas.
Nice.
Just random things that I like to do. I do the same thing here in Australia. I've done that a few times now, driven from Adelaide to Sydney, which is nearly 17, 18 hours driving.
Wow.
Yeah. You only have to do that maybe twice in your life.
How far is Darwin hours if you drove it?
That's probably about 2.5 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we're weird to think that Australia is this little smallish country that, yeah, like you're right next door to New Zealand, and, you know, Perth must be next to Melbourne. It's all like Europe. It's kind of close together.
Yeah.
But, you know, most Americans don't know what country is south or north of us. So that's, you know.
And it's three days to drive to Perth from where I, so I'm in the middle, like where I am, I'm on the south central coast, and you have a friend from Adelaide. So I'm hoping they've told you something about our sleepy little town, but I'm sort of like in the middle of everything. So I can go east or west, and it's, well, yeah. Perth is about 3 days. Darwin is 2 days. New Zealand is 4 hours to fly. So,
not that. Okay.
I'd sooner go to New Zealand than to Perth, or Darwin, actually, for that matter. Darwin is like, I don't know how would you explain it. Put an oven in your refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been to Louisiana?
Yeah, I have. I've been to New Orleans. I've spent some time in Mississippi too. So it doesn't really get refrigerator or cold like there, but it, it gets
not cold. It never gets cold in Darwin. But like the moisture, like when you open the refrigerator, you get the moisture. It's humid, and right now it's called the silly season up there, because if you spend too long, it'll make you go silly.
Okay. So basically it's the kind of place your clothes stick to you and nobody really cares because.
Yeah. Yeah. You have a shower and dry yourself just to get wet again. It's weird.
Sounds very Darwinian.
Darwinian. Yes. And then in the winter time, which is supposedly the nicer time to go, the weather is like, the temperatures are in the 80s, 90s, 100s. It's hot, but it's dry. So then it becomes like Arizona. Yeah.
Okay, well, New Zealand sounds like a better deal.
Yeah, I think so too. Listen, tell me about yourself, because the listeners are probably thinking, what the fuck are you talking about? talking about Darwin. You are a contributor on Forbes. You have written for ESPN. You've written for Rolling Stone. And now you've written this book, 90 Days in the 90s, which is still on my list. I haven't gotten to it yet, which is really disappointing for me. But tell me about it. Who are you and what is this book?
Yeah, I'm basically a freelance contributor, sports writer, and I write for Forbes now, mostly doing sports business and sports stories. So I've gotten it built up from a long time ago, but I've gotten to interview a lot of really great athletes. So I've interviewed Shaquille O'Neal and Tom Brady and Megan Rapinoe and Billie Jean King and also, like, you know, athletes that you may not know off the top of your head. And that really came a long way from, like, I don't know, like 10, 12 years ago when I was covering. I was working in the business world, you know, was always probably a writer inside and just kind of wanted to dabble a little bit in. Got the first thing I ever got published actually was an article for Rolling Stone about it was kind of in the extreme sports column. It wasn't anything about like baseball or football, basketball or soccer. So yeah, I got one article in there covering an extreme sport, which is called fistball, which is kind of like volleyball with a little other bells and whistles. And just from there, started doing like sort of whatever they take from me. Did a little bit of local high school football here in Chicago. They kind of assigned me to the Southside Catholic League, which is, you know, Southside Irish Catholic school kids. The schools would either be like the fans are really polite and behave, or the fans are yelling curse words and epithets at the coach. You know, so it's all kinds, all the degrees in between. And yeah, just kind of like kept going with that and wrote for ESPN for about 6 years, kind of moved from. I mostly did extreme sports and a little bit of pop culture back when they had Page Two. So Page Two was kind of like the offbeat sports stories page. So I got to interview a couple of rock stars. I interviewed Noel Gallagher from Oasis and Morrissey from the Smiths, although I didn't talk to him. We just did an email exchange and kind of asked them about their sports hankerings and their music and stuff. And it was kind of a weird combination, extreme sports and aging rock stars talking about their sports ups. And eventually just made some connections and got to write for Rolling Stone after that for about 2 years. And over the course of that transformation, went from interviewing like high school kids to, you know, tell me about how you scored that touchdown, to some maybe minor NFL stars and some extreme sports stars. And then eventually covered the World Series for Rolling Stone. And then from there, you know, I guess PR people and publicists started to find me and started, you know, offering, you know, do you want to talk to this athlete? Do you want to talk to Hall of Famer Johnny Bench about, you know, grilling out and baseball? Do you want to talk to this person, that person? So I just kind of built on that. And so now it's, you know, it's a lot of professional athletes and a lot of retired sports legends. And then people, actually, Juan Aussie I interviewed a couple of times and I've met him in person is Greg Norman, the golfer, Hall of Fame golfer. He's kind of, you know, he's kind of, I guess, setting the golf world the golf world on fire, not in a good way. He's kind of there's some animosity in the golf world thanks to the new league that he started with the Saudi money. But, you know, I interviewed him before that, and it's great to kind of just talk to these big sports stars about, you know, daily nuts and bolts and what they like to do when they're not winning championships. And other than that, I'm a huge music fan. So I live in Chicago since 1994. That's how old I am, more than half my life. And wrote this book about the 90s music scene called 90 Days in the 90s. And in a nutshell, it is about a woman who's a record store owner. She's about my age. And she discovers a way to time travel back to the 90s. And once she finds out that this urban legend about the Grey Line train is real, she decides to go back to 1996 to kind of fix some things and do some things over. And then just gets caught up having way too much fun in the 90s and caught up in the music scene. And, you know, that's part of the problem. So.
That's so the 90s that's my era. That's where I grew up in the 90s. I'm an 80s baby. So the 90s was when I was old enough to do things I can remember. Like
me too, actually. You
know, yeah, yeah. So what made you want to write about the 90s? What made you pick that particular decade?
Well, part of it, of course, you know, I think a lot of writers want to write a book and you toy with ideas like, oh, that'd be a cool idea for a book. Why should I write about this? And, you know, that happens like a bunch of times. And you know, there's sort of the old classic story about like someone coming up with the most brilliant idea in the world and writing it on a bar napkin that they find like that goes through the wash. And you know, yeah. But that's not how it happened. And I love 90s music. I love all music from all decades. But I think so. I was in 1990. I graduated from high school. And so the 90s for me was like young adulthood. Graduated college, moved out of my house, you know, had a roommate in the city, lived in the city in Chicago. I wasn't going to live in the suburbs and kind of got to experience things. And there's so one of the themes of the book is nostalgia. Woody Allen in the movie called Midnight in Paris, they talk about the golden age fallacy, which is like everything in the past is great and better. So there's part of me that thinks about like, yeah, I mean, I had no responsibility. I could go to see, you know, concerts and rock shows at small clubs and, you know, but I forget that I was broke and ate ramen noodles every night for dinner, or I had to like, you know, spend a couple of days kind of assembling a roll of quarters so that I could do my laundry at the end. And I'd go downstairs to the dungeon basement of my apartment and wait for two people to finish so I could wash my, you know, my clothes for work at 11:30 at night on a Sunday. Like I forget those things. So the nostalgia and kind of the bright side of nostalgia is the part of it. So, I just got this idea one day walking around, listening to my 90s music playlist on Spotify, thinking, I don't know what I thought about specifically, but I remember thinking like, oh, it would be cool like if I could go see the show again. If I could time travel back to see whatever music thing I was thinking about. And I think about the 90s where there's bands that I've been in line to see them. The club, you know, sells out and I can't see it. Or when the House of Blues opened up in Chicago, I want to say, I think it was around New Year's Day, 96, James Brown played. He opened the venue. That's pretty cool. I didn't have a lot of money when I was 22, but I definitely didn't have friends who could get me on the guest list or get tickets, and I didn't go to that thing. And, you know, James Brown died. I never got to see him. But there's all kinds of incidences like that where I thought, you know, we hear a lot in movies and film and literature about time travel. We think about Back to the Future and all those great movies, or Peggy Sue Got Married, or Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And they're always supposed to, like, they got some big thing. And a lot of times in movies, it's like the person who goes back in time is supposed to just kill Hitler or prevent 9/11 from happening or prevent someone from dying. And I wanted to play with that theme to have it be about like, I probably, if I could go back in time right now and not, you know, it wouldn't mess up my life currently. If I could just go be a tourist, time travel tourist, I would probably go check out a concert, go see Nirvana's first show in Chicago in 1991. I might even just go to a taco place I used to love that is no longer in existence. Because, you know, now there's a friggin' Target there or whatever the hell. But so I'm really into like the small joys in life, like a good bagel, a good slice of pizza and some chocolate, half a glass of wine, a sunny day, and having a 3-hour lunch with people who you like. I mean, I think I'm pretty driven as a writer, but then I combine those two things. I thought, well, if I got to write a book, if I want to write a book, it's got to have a plot that's compelling. And the other side of it was I could talk about movies of the 90s, but a lot of the movies that I like in the 90s, the stories, like take either Friday or Pulp Fiction. In both those movies, I'm not a gangster from South Central. I'm not a gangster, you know, who works for Marcellus Wallace, who can go like do a hit, and a guy, I don't know, whatever the plot is like. I normally couldn't hang with those people, the characters in the movie. I felt like I was tagging along with those characters for that movie. And that's what I wanted to try to achieve in the book, that you're reading the book, you're hanging out with Darby, who, one day she's managing a record store and the next day she's going back to the 90s, and you're sort of tagging along, and it's more about the experience than, you know, any historical stuff or any sort of moral problems or major moral problems. That's how it was a lot of trial and error and a lot of it evolved. The first draft is nothing like the end product of the book, but I had a lot of fun along the way.
Is it You were talking about a train. So obviously, is that a local train? Like, is it set in Chicago? Is that where you've written from?
Yeah. So if you saw the cover, 90 Days in the 90s, and you can, you know, go to 90daysinthe90s.com. If any of the listeners can find it on Amazon. It's you'll see what looks like a train car on the front, some lightning bolts and stuff. Yeah. So,
like what's behind you. Time travel
books, I mean, I suppose there's probably time travel stories where the person just has a dream and they end up in another time. I think to make stories compelling, there's got to be, I didn't want it to be a sci-fi book because I'm not a sci-fi geek, and I didn't do well in science class. So I just tried to make it simple. I thought, well, I got to come up with a time travel mechanism. In Chicago, we have this thing called the L. So the L has a couple lines. It's not as big as New York by any means, but the red line goes north and south, you know, literally from the top of the city to the way, you know, like almost the south suburbs. You'll pass by Guaranteed Rate Field where the White Sox play, for example, and you can take it for the most part to get to Soldier Field, but you got to walk a little bit. And then there's the blue line that goes to the airport, pretty much just downtown loop, probably where you were and you visited, straight to the airport and back. There's an orange line that goes to the other airport. There's the brown line, which pretty much goes to the north side. So I thought about that theme that I guess I was almost going to run out of colors. So I picked, I decided to make it the gray line. And the gray line is kind of a gray area of thought, but it's an urban legend. And I could talk about urban legends. Urban legends to me was also another part of the 90s, in part because we all got acclimated to technology and bam, there we were. But a lot of urban legends floated around. So Darby kind of she moves back to Chicago after she takes over her uncle's record store. She kind of hears these urban myths about the time travel train called the Gray Line. It's, you know, it's like the New Jersey Devil or the Mothman. It probably doesn't exist. But she eventually finds that it does exist. There's a Gray Line stop under her record store, and that sort of precipitates the decision. You know, should I go back? I could fix some things. I could go back. I could make up with my girlfriend, or I could, you know, I don't do this better, do that better. And, you know, that's sort of the, I guess, the natural emotional human side of the decision there, that there's an opportunity and she decides to take it. And the gray line, you know, the subway train station is the time travel mechanism that, and I won't spoil too much, but she does jump on a couple of times when she decides that she can go to see a couple legendary concerts within Chicago, that she starts using it a little bit more as a local would.
Right, right. First, you mentioned that your main character has a girlfriend, and I think you mentioned this in an email to me that your main character is non-binary.
Sort of.
Is that what you said? Sort of non-binary.
She's actually, I mean, I guess using sort of old world terms, she's bisexual, or she's, you know, fluid. I think some of my friends who are like her say she's fluid. She actually starts out in the first chapter, you're hearing about her Wall Street career falling apart because she made some bad crypto trades. I'll raise my hands. I'm not a huge fan of crypto, but whatever. And she has a fiance, a dude named Alan, who's kind of like a vanilla, boring kind of person that she probably shouldn't be with anyway. Right. Their relationship falls apart right when her favorite uncle, Martin, who owns a record store in Chicago that she also lost touch with, she feels guilty about that, dies, and she finds that she, well, you're like right at the present where she's got this record store. But then, once you get more into it, you find out then I had to address it a couple times that, yeah, she used to date women, or she's, you know, she doesn't define herself by who she dates necessarily, which I didn't originally make that choice thinking I'm going to make this a LGBT, you know, QI book, or I'm going to make a statement.
Yeah,
about
I was
it.
Curious about that. Like what drove you to, yeah. What was it that made you think, oh, I'm going to do this? Like,
yeah, well, I would just say, just to kind of fill in on her, that she, you know, I try to normalize that because in my world, that's okay. I don't judge people by, or even like get hung up on like, are they gay or straight? Are they dating a man or woman? Right. What's up with that? I think we should be beyond that. That's just,
we
my
should.
Opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's 2022.
It's 2022. So let's get with it. So originally, without boring you with too many details, I started out the book kind of like brain dumping, and it was about, you know, someone kind of more like me, middle-aged straight white guy who owns a record store. And I think somewhere, you know, after 4.5 years of Trump being in our face every day on the news, and George Floyd and Me Too in the fall of 2020, I'm walking my dog one day and I just have this eureka moment where I think, you know, I think probably the last thing people need to hear about right now is a middle-aged white guy who wants to go back to the past when things were better for him. And I was like, holy shit. Like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. And I kind of backed up my decision. I thought about, I literally like made the decision while walking the dog. It wasn't a hard one. Not because I thought, bam, I'm going to make it more interesting. It was more like, I interview a ton of athletes. I interview a ton of legends, you know, retired sports legends, half of whom, or maybe 51%, are women. I mean, I can tell you about Tom Brady and Shaq and Richard Sherman, but in the last 6 months, I've interviewed Billie Jean King, Lindsey Vonn, Jenny Finch, who's, you know, the world's best softball pitcher, if you don't know softball. Allyson Felix, who's has won a boatload of gold medals as a sprinter. So I thought, you know, my gig on the side there, writing for Forbes, which is one of my couple of jobs, has always been kind of taking someone else's story or describing to you, the audience, what's important about this person. You know them as a professional athlete. They've got some other cool things going on. A lot of time it's like a business venture, but then what they think about this or what's important in their lives. And I kind of took that is an opportunity, like I could make this character more interesting and more kind of honest to the time and not make it about, you know, a bunch of white guys in a record store talking about, you know, whether Led Zeppelin 2 or 3 was better. Like we can get bored. I guess a great writer can pull off all that off, but I wanted to kind of be more here and now. And I just felt more, eventually when I made the decision, it felt more honest to just kind of roll with Darby kind of being who she is and not defined. Like, I didn't want to be the straight guy who's a writer who tries to write a gay novel. It wasn't even about that. It was more like, let's follow this character. She is who she is. You know, just like maybe we hear a lot in movies and books about straight guys, there's a non-commitment thing. She can have that too.
Yeah. Yeah.
She can know more about sports and music than you and I combined.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess like a Generation Xer, which I am, she's got a healthy sense of cynicism, but she's not a downer or a pessimist. And that's, you know, kind of maybe a generational characteristic. And it just kind of worked organically. And I kept working at it. And it kind of brought the other characters around her to life when, you know, they interact in dialogue and whatever else.
Has writing always been a passion for you? Like, if we talk about 10-year-old Andy, was that something that you were always thinking about?
I think so. And maybe how I got started in sports. Like, I was never really disciplined as a student, so I wasn't really disciplined as a writer until probably technology and social media came along. Because, like, in my day, we took a typing class, and I sucked at typing. And I like to handwrite things, but that's not the way to get published. But I remember
not
like
anymore.
I guess I was probably 11 in fourth grade. It was a summer of, I want to say, 1982. And it just snowed and snowed and snowed, sort of recess, you know, what we call recess here in the U.S. You know, playtime between morning and afternoon period. We were snowed in playing board games. And all of a sudden, my little school in Pennsylvania got hit with this fanatical wave of chess. Everybody's playing chess, mostly boys, but some girls were playing chess too. And right at that time, I think because we were in fourth grade, we were old enough we could write for the school newspaper, fourth and fifth graders mostly. And I decided to write my first sports article about chess in the fourth grade. And, you know, I interviewed some people. I think I got a quote or two, maybe not. I don't remember now, but it was, you know, my standard first, like, this is an interesting thing happening and I'm reporting about it, and kind of hopped along from that. I didn't write constantly. I kind of, it was a journeyman, just popped in and out. And when I had interesting things to say and write about, and I wrote a couple things in the college paper, but not like, I wasn't a columnist. I wasn't a journalism major. So I kind of hopped around enough of my life, kind of doing it half-assed. And I guess when I got passionate about it was when I was in the workforce, you know, crunching numbers and, you know, selling bank products and insurance. And I just needed something to keep me sane. And then writing became that. But I wanted to do more with it than just, you know, rant and write a blog that nobody read.
Yeah. I get that. I think that it actually seems to be a common thread, like with people that I talk to who have written something, that there's always this moment where they come to it at some point. You know, they've played with it at some point in their life. And then I talk to other people who have never written anything and they've never thought about writing anything. They never did when they were at school. It's always like when you're in those formative years that you pick something up and you just think, actually, I could do this. I enjoy doing this. And even if it was just something you're playing with back then, you know, when you were 11-year-old Andy, that stays with you or something.
Yeah, maybe that's where the gig economy comes from too, that we're all kind of dabblers a little bit. And if you get a little bit passionate about something you're dabbling with and maybe think you can make some money, or that you're having enough fun that you keep doing it, making birdhouses or whatever, or, you know, a podcast even, you know, that it can come alive from there.
Yeah. Is that what you've been doing? Have you been on TaskRabbit? Is that your...
TaskRabbit. Yeah. I've used TaskRabbit to help me move a piece of furniture that's way too big for me to carry myself. But, I don't know. Like, I'm fascinated with these little stories, especially with sports and music and that. So I wrote for ESPN Page 2 for a while. And every Wednesday I would tune in because Duff McKagan from Guns N' Roses would write a weekly column on Wednesdays. Now, he would write it himself. He's actually a great writer. Some funny stories about him. I've never met the guy, but I'd love to. And he apparently in his book, the reason he plays bass for Guns N' Roses, like he was a guitarist and a bass player, is that he moved to L.A. and somebody broke into his place and stole his guitars and left the bass there.
So
So, you know, fate has made, I don't know if I believe in fate in all meanings of it, but that's something pretty cool that happened, I suppose, that, you know, he's basically Guns N' Roses, and he could have been a second-rate guitarist for another band, but it all sort of worked out because something happened and he ran with it. So,
what do they call that? There's a word for that. Oh, I'm usually actually I have a really good vocabulary. Serendipity, that's the word. there's always something. I do find now I've produced more than 60 episodes for this podcast. I've released about 40 of those, but I've had a chance to speak to a lot of people that there's always that serendipity. There's always that serendipitous moment that they come to whatever it is they're doing and they're perfect for it. And I have read like the first maybe 5 pages of, I feel really bad about it. I've got 13 books that I'm reading all at the same time. Plus I'm studying law and I'm working full time. So I'm not using it as an excuse. I'm just saying like, it's really busy. So I will get there and I will finish it because I loved the idea of the book, the 90 days in the 90s. And the 90s was awesome. It was an awesome decade. So of course I want to read more about it. And what is that? Like a reminiscing type thing. Maybe I can relate to some things. I wasn't in Chicago in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I was actually in 1999. Well, there you go. I was
a couple days.
I was there. Yeah. But there's got to be something that I can connect to. And I connected to the, you know, your intro to the book. And so I've read the start of the book. excuse me. So, but there's always something. And I find that really fascinating to find out what was that one thing? What was the catalyst that said to you, this is what I need to do? You'd already been writing for ESPN. That's different to writing a book. You'd been writing for Forbes. You've been writing your sports writer for Forbes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also for Rolling Stone, which is completely different to writing a book.
Yeah, then I wrote about pop culture and interviewed aging rock stars for ESPN, so it was kind of ass backwards, but, you know, things happen that way. I did actually interview one rock star for Rolling Stone. I interviewed Jerry Cantrell from Alice in Chains. Guess what? I was talking to him about his fantasy football league, but it was like a charity fantasy football league where the prizes were, oh, Elton John just donated a box in one of his, to one of his Vegas shows. Like the kind that cost $50,000. Like he donated that. One of the prizes you could win if you, I think it was from a silent auction or a raffle or something like that, which they used to raise money for Wounded Warriors, I think. So, but he was, we talked about sports and we talked about talking sports trash the way that sports fans do. And we talked about, why Physical Graffiti in his mind was the greatest Led Zeppelin album. Like he said the F word about 50 times just out of enthusiasm.
you can say that word. I say it all the time. I'm Australian.
Publicist was like, I think you got him he was actually in a good mood, maybe he's not in a good mood when he talks to journalists, but I try to keep it conversational and try to be like that with everybody and try to make my book conversational. So it didn't feel that much different. Like the task is different when you got to write, like you got chapters going on and some scenes and you got to kind of link them. That's different than like an 800-word sports article, but I don't know. The energy is kind of the same, I guess.
You just mentioned something. Now, I'm completely ignorant. It is something that I've heard about, obviously, fantasy football. Okay. It's not big here. Not yet. It is picking up because I've noticed it on a few shows that I've been watching on Netflix as part of my research for another guest I'm speaking to in a few months. It is growing. What is it? It's not real, right? It's not actually. You are putting together your own team, yeah?
Yeah, and it's been around for like the last time I did fantasy, I did an NBA fantasy when Jordan came back the second time for the Washington Wizards. So yeah, like you assemble, you try to cherry pick your favorite players from all the teams. The tough part of the NBA and baseball is like you have to change your roster every night because if you have your first baseman is somebody who's not playing because they're off that night, then you lose points. But fantasy football is kind of the biggest because the NFL is really the biggest sport here. So every Sunday you got, I don't know, maybe Tom Brady's your quarterback and somebody from the Raiders is your wide receiver. And then you like this running back from this. So you put it all together and kind of the net result is how well they do in terms of like yardage and points scored your quarterback gets sacked 4 times. Probably not having a weekend there in your fantasy football league, but it's really good for the diehard fans. Most of the people I know who do fantasy football are in like 3 leagues, which just one would be, I don't even do it, but one would be way too much for me. And you're kind of analytical about it and you're kind of competitive because you want to beat your friends and maybe you got money down on it. So the winner gets $500 or $1,000 at the end of the season. I do during So in March, you might have heard of March Madness. We have the college basketball tournament. I do that. I try to be not emotional about it and not pick my favorite teams. Because I grew up in Philadelphia. If I pick all the Philadelphia teams, only one's going to be around in the second round. But that's fun because it's like a one-shot deal. You care about it for 3 weeks. And you pick your team and their bracket just works. You don't have to like change your pitcher or change, if you're doing football, change your quarterback and who's your kicker. Like if your team, if the kicker's on a team where they're just killing it and they score four touchdowns, they don't need the kicker to do anything. Well, your kicker didn't really get that many points. So you kind of fool yourself. But yeah, okay. It's always been done. I guess probably in the 80s, people sat around and wrote it on paper. The first time I did it.
Oh,
in
it's
the
that
late...
long ago. It's like, it's huge. It's been around for a long time.
But I mean, it really sort of, I guess, became a thing it in the 90s when you had like Yahoo and some of the search engines would have their league where you sign up just like you would a Facebook group. And then you invite people and then, you can have as many people as you want. And then you have a draft, they pick your teams, you pick the people on your team and then you're ready by week one. And, you're on top of like managing your team, like a football manager would.
Right.
So I think it's a little overrated. I'm not at a place in my life where I want to spend a lot of time doing that, but it's a huge industry. It's not just a pastime. It's like a huge friggin' industry and you could bet money.
It seems like it. I thought it was brand new, like just a brand new thing that's come out, with the dawn of apps and shit like that on your phones. And I thought it was just like a new kind of app that everybody could get involved in. But somebody else said it was like, there's some gambling involved. Like you can actually put real money in and,
yeah, wow. There's gambling apps and there's fantasy apps that, they basically fill the need. So instead of me sitting down at my desk and going to Yahoo and going to the link where my team is, like, yeah, it's all on your phone now. And
it's on your phone. Bet,
yeah, I mean, that's what we've evolved to. So yeah. I'm fascinated by that technology. Not enough to do it, but yeah, it's something for everybody.
Yeah, I don't. I'm just like, now that I know a little bit about it, I don't think I'm going to get it. I actually really enjoy American football. We have Australian football here, which is completely different. And I know I think it's FS1 over there in the US. They play our Australian rules football matches. And you're like up to date. I think you get the matches pretty much hours after we've had them here. So, and I noticed that because I have Fubo TV. So I noticed that I think it was FS1 that it came up on. So you guys know now what Australian rules football is. It's completely different to what you guys have as football.
I actually kind of pay attention during the Olympics to the, I think, there's like rugby sevens, which just moves like lightning speed. And I remember watching Fiji kick the crap out of Great Britain. I think it's sort of the Olympics I'm thinking of. And so the game, like, I feel like rugby sevens could be big here. That's kind of like American fans, strangely, except for NFL football, most of our sports, we want to see stuff. We want to see scoring right away. We want to see things happen.
Yeah.
Kind of impatient. So, the rules are rugby sevens could probably make it here in the US with a little bit of push, but I see it all the time. And I could bore you with stories about going to pubs, having to pay $20 because an English football game was on Sky. And I used to work with a bunch of English dudes from South London who, what do we do on Saturday at 8 a.m? We went to the pub to watch West Ham play Man United or whatever. And I love that.
Yeah.
The first couple of years we had to like pay at the door and go into a separate room. TV deal. I don't know much about that that racket, but it was, I still watched the sports and coughed up the money when I needed to.
Yeah, it's big in the UK, especially. Like I've spent time there, and to go and watch the football with your mates down at the pub, and hardcore fans, like that's their ritual. It's okay for me. I'll do it every now and then, but tennis is my sport. That's what I prefer to watch, and I don't have to go anywhere to watch that.
Cool.
I can watch that here. It's on TV all the time. All of the Opens. I want to ask you, I want to go away because this season we're asking some random questions. What is the most valuable lesson that you've learned in 2022? It could be with anything, like even because you've released your book and stuff, but what's hit you the most?
I've learned a long time, but I keep reviewing this in my head. And so like relationships matter, like building, I'm thinking like in business, but also in publishing a book, like building relationships is everything. You think about like, how do you get along with your neighbors? Well, you introduce yourself to them and you have, you don't have to like everything they do, but you have a relationship with them instead of, you know, not knowing them and getting your pants in a bunch about the fact that, you know, their sticks are on your lawn. Like, we could always find things to get angry about, but I think when we take the time to know people, at least to some degree, but to the degree that's tolerable, good things happen. So in releasing this book, yeah, I just kind of tried to leverage that and reach out to local bookstores. And, you know, when you drop by and say hello, or, you know, you thank somebody by leaving a box of chocolates, it actually like does make a difference that they do remember you, and people appreciate the small gesture. So, yeah, I think relationships with people are everything, even if, you know, I like people less than I used to, you know, thanks to our political, I guess, environment. Yeah. People aren't as cool as they were in the 90s. Maybe that's the reason I wrote the book. But at the same time, even with that in mind, kind of proceeding cautiously, that, you know, if you try to value people and you put relationships first and build bridges, like, that makes a huge difference.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking about that then, because you're talking about that the relationships are important, what is an insult that you've received from somebody, but you're proud of it?
Oh, that I'm a Gen Xer.
Because not everyone's going to be nice, right?
I've seen a lot of, I think there was something floating around the news last week where someone has like a, it was like a graph of like the generational breakdown, and they sort of mischaracterized this. They basically lumped, you know, people my age group in with people who are like 15 to 20 years older than me, saying like, this age group is pro-Trump, and someone put up like, what's wrong with you people? And I was like, first of all, I'm not part of you people. Yeah. I guess as a Generation Xer, I'm proud of my gray hair and that my taste in music does not include dubstep and, we're a little bit ornery and kind of not having the nonsense that everybody else has. We're just sort of, you know, I don't know. I'm old, but more independent than you give me credit for.
Yeah. Who are the people that like dubstep, by the way?
That's just my kind of like, you know, when millennials are like, you know, millennials in America are like, we're the greatest generation ever. And, you know, we invented innovative type of music, but I'm like, but you also invented dubstep, and you know, your biggest star is a former Mouseketeer on the Disney Channel. So music, or we can go toe to toe.
Yeah. Yeah. Dubstep has never been in my cycle ever. Yeah. I'm glad I'm a little bit older than that. I think I don't know what I'm even called. You said you're a Gen Xer. I don't know what I am.
How old are you? I'm
41.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, like, you're, I guess the media would call you millennial. I think there's kind of a gradient.
I've heard that.
Like Gen X and Gen Y, and, you know, millennials are really people who grew up in the 2000s. That's actually where the term came from. Mm. But specifically your taste in music are, but, you know, you identify by having grown up a little bit, at least an important part of your life in the 90s. So,
yeah,
I think that kind of speaks more to generation. I'm not a sociologist, but I kind of associate generations with things that happen. So for me, it's like, I think of Gen X as, you know, they say 1965 to 80, but I think of like people who were born after the Vietnam War, and, you know, were the MTV generation. Like, we had all the Gen Xers had all the cool
MTV
stuff.
Yeah
we first generation to watch MTV, the first generation to get email addresses at work, you know, like, to start working the professional world with email addresses. And maybe we're the first generation to be emailed directly by a Nigerian prince who wants to give us $400.
I just had one 3 days ago, 4 days ago. I don't even know where they were from, actually. It was really random. It funny enough, came through on, I have a different email address for the show. And so it came through on the show's email address saying that, it pissed me off because these people are taking advantage of like tragic shit happening in the world. But a relative of mine had fallen victim to the shit that's going on in Russia, Ukraine. And Well, in Ukraine, thanks to Russia, let's just be realistic about it. But because of this relative, you know, they had a substantial amount of money, 500 million, I think it was, that my, I don't have any relatives in Ukraine and I don't have any relatives in Russia. So like, who's leaving me $500 million? But I remember the Nigerian prince, I used to get them in the mail with a stamp on the letter. I used to actually get letters in the post from these lawyers.
Yeah. I've heard more about that recently. I mean, I remember the first time when I got the chain letters, we used to call it, the chain letter that I'd gotten twice in the mail. And then it came in an email form. And I'm like, really? Really? It could be more like you basically just put this in an email and sent it out.
Yeah.
And so I kind of wonder which one of my, you know, hippie friends gave out my mailing and email. Probably email, you can find an address anywhere. But you know, back when it was all analog and paper, that somehow somebody got my address, and I don't know, I didn't get scared by it. Of course, you know, if you don't forward the letter on, you're gonna, you know, your heart's gonna be plucked from your breast and your body.
That's right. Yes, they used to. Yeah, if you don't forward within 24 hours, you're gonna lose your life. Oh God. I've seen it. I loved those days. They were good. I used to challenge it. You know, I'm testing you. Go on. I'm not forwarding this email.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. Before we go, I have one more question. And this is something that I want to know about all my guests this year. What do people misunderstand about you the most?
I don't know. You know, it's weird. So I think I was definitely not a good athlete in high school. I wouldn't have been described as a jock, but I think people who know me just from like my adult life think that I'm, you know, like I must've been on the football team. Like I'm not very tall. So it's definitely, that doesn't make sense, but I was a jock in high school because, you know,
because you ride a sport.
I hit the gym and I drink lots of water and try to stay fit. And I actually kind of care about my health, and I've played sports as an adult with people who are less athletic than me, and I think that they think I'm just, you know, a dumb jock or something like that. So I find that fascinating. That if you'd seen me in high school as the artsy kid, you know, you wouldn't have the opinions you have about me now. So I think it's been a few since I've really thought about that, but I think that's one of those things that because I like sports, I must be. Yeah, I'm the hyper jock who's in five fantasy football leagues, and I like to, you know, punch holes in the wall and be uber masculine. But
do you work with a lot of people who are like that?
Well, in the business world, like if you're kind of in a Wall Street career, there's some of that. Strangely, like part of my financial career, I worked in there. So in Chicago, we have these trading markets. We got like Chicago Board of Trade and the Merck, and where there's a lot of expatriates here because of that. There probably wouldn't be any reason to have people from London and Southeast Asia, you know, having jobs here in Chicago in the middle of the U.S., middle of the Midwest, without those financial markets, people who trade, you know, I don't know, corn and wheat and silver and platinum. So I got, I was surrounded by guys from South London and a couple of my jobs, guys who didn't go to college, who are super well-dressed. They all wore like pink and purple ties. And strangely, most of them are West Ham fans. And so that was a different type of hyper uber sports fan. It's definitely different from Meathead Tommy, who's talking about football nonstop. And, you know, he's from the suburb. You know, there's different kinds of sports fans. And I started to get off on a tangent, but so I think the reason I'm fascinated with sports and I write about sports is that it's so much more diverse than we give it credit for. Just like, I think anything you're in law. I think a lot of people have a kind of a archetype about the lawyer, you know, kind of the archetype of the lawyer, you know, Jim Carrey, liar, or, you know, Phil Hartman is the unfrozen caveman lawyer on SNL from the late 80s. And I said, there's this kind of marmy snake oil salesman type of person, but I've known lawyers who are like the most shy people I know, and they like to push paper and figure stuff out. Very different from being a trial lawyer. So anything's,
I've seen that myself too, Andy.
So you'll be the guy who cracks the case. You're not going to be like eating raw meat in front of the judge, you know, the super aggressive type.
If I could help it, I probably don't want to be in front of a judge, but
there you go.
I don't want to be a trial lawyer at all. Like, I have no interest in that at all, but yes, you're absolutely right. And so I have this preconceived idea that the people who are writing about sport are like Ray Romano from Everybody Loves Raymond. Like, that's my idea of someone who writes about sport. They're not necessarily the sporty type. They just, they know a lot about sport, so they write about it for the people who are playing the sport or who are really into the sport. Because I don't see people who are playing sport writing stuff all the time. They're not the people that I'm talking to.
Yeah, I think audience, so I teach college kids some courses in digital marketing, and I always talk all the time about, like, think about your audience. Like, you're doing cool stuff that you're writing or you're podcasting or whatever, but I think you should always keep your audience in mind. And that's, I think, if I've learned anything in being a writer, that one, I got to tell somebody else's story, but I got to make it so that the person reading this cares, not because I'm feeling all great about myself because I interviewed this athlete. Like, I've got to make it be relatable to the person on the other end. So I think that's, maybe another lesson I've learned is be relatable, think about your audience, and, kind of take it easy, to be happy to telling someone else's story, because that's where the action's at.
Yeah, I've learned that to myself too. When I first started out this, I thought, oh God, I'm going to be talking to all these people that no one knows about. And if I want to be popular, this is how I started. It's not how I feel anymore. But when I first started, if I want to be popular, I've got to get the big names right away. And I was really proud of myself that I landed someone from a hit TV show, and their episode is coming up in November. But that was awesome. But actually, the more I talked to them, I thought, this is just another person. And then I started to change the way I thought about the people that I'm talking to, because this show isn't for everyone. I'm completely aware of that. And I've received reviews, and I've received some malicious emails, and thank you so much for them. because they didn't like it, but you don't have to like it. It's not for everyone, but it is for someone. And I've received more messages and support from people who have enjoyed the content that I'm creating and enjoyed the people that I'm talking to, who are not mega A-list celebrities, because you don't need to be to have a good message and touch someone, I guess, for lack of a better word, to just touch something in someone and make them realize that actually you've got something that's worthwhile to them.
Yeah, let's talk about tennis. So you're a tennis fan. You're Australian. I'll tell you that one of my more unique interviews was with Ash Barty. Actually,
I got to interview her.
She the one week she was like number two to Naomi Osaka for like a week or two. When I talked to her, I think I want to say it was in the fall, but she was like she was the opposite of every athlete I've talked to. Like, she didn't really want to pump herself up. I'm like, what's it like when you're when you come against the top competitors, what goes through your mind? And a lot of her answers were like, I don't know, I don't really think about it, just do it. I was pulling teeth a little bit with her, but she just doesn't brag about herself. She's kind of more into like hanging out with her boyfriend and her nieces. And, I feel like, as a fan, I feel like she retired too soon, but that's not my business. She retired after winning Wimbledon and when she felt like she needed to retire. Because I don't know, how old is she? Like 31? She's not that old.
She's, I think, 10 years younger than me. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, but she was unique in that she was just kind of who she was and didn't have any like pizzazz, pal stories to tell me about. It was just like you're saying, just talk about it. So if you get her, I don't know if she does interviews anymore, but yeah, she's super down to earth and, almost borderline on like, not being the greatest interview, because she's just kind of wants to be herself.
I've noticed that myself too when I've seen her on TV, even after a match, and I can see that she's not you can see in certain athletes, they want to be there in front of you, the reporter, they want to be in front of the camera, and Ash has never come across as that kind of person. Whenever I've seen her after winning a game or whatever, even when you're reading things about her, and she's very humble. Mm-hmm. I like that though. I like that kind of person. I feel a deeper connection with somebody who is just aware of themselves a little bit more than someone who wants to be out in the in the spotlight all the time talking about themselves, which is fine. I mean, it's totally okay. And I'm all for having someone talk about themselves for 45 minutes to an hour. But it's a very different episode when they do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go.
I'll look into that. She's from Queensland. She's a Queenslander. Queenslanders also are more laid back too, which I think is where she gets that very calm sort of, I don't want to talk about it type thing, because Queenslanders are very modest. They don't like to big themselves. They're very chilled. Adelaide is also very chilled. It's not like Sydney and Melbourne that are very, you know, yeah. So I'm a superstar.
Which city is Sydney and Melbourne, and your Indiana or Texas is I guess Adelaide, you know, in terms of laid back.
Yeah, Sydney's the New York of Australia. Sydney's definitely the New York of Australia. Melbourne is very Los Angeles. It's very chilled, cafe culture vibe, like, you know, that type of thing. But they have better transport than LA. I've talked about that with some friends from LA too, but yeah. And Adelaide, Adelaide is probably, have you ever been to Austin?
I've not, but so I got a 16-year-old who's talking about wanting to go to college there, because my 16-year-old loves music like I do, and he's got like 5 guitars. So we're only talking about like going to a college, a place like Austin that has something going for it besides the college. So yeah, I've not been there yet. I want to go. I know that South by Southwest is like hard to find a hotel room but I just want to go on like an off weekend. And so you've been to Austin?
I've been to Austin, and there's a reason that Austin is the sister city of Adelaide, because it's very similar. The culture is all very similar. Even the people that come from there, I feel like I'm at home when I'm there.
Wow. Do you have a lot of live music in Adelaide then?
Yes. Yeah, we do. We're the festival. So where we are, we're the festival state. Pretty much all year round, there's a festival of some type going on. Coming up in November, we have the Feast Festival, which is the LGBTIQ+ festival, but heaps of live acts, live music, live stuff is what we like here. Currently, we've got 9 to 5, the musical playing, and we're about to have Hairspray, and it's a big thing for us. We really should be like Melbourne. Melbourne get a lot of that stuff. They're the theater place. Adelaide should be the theater place. This is where the big shows should be coming to. But unfortunately, we get looked over. We're overlooked by a lot of the big acts, and they don't come to Adelaide.
Shame on them.
Celine Dion, if you're listening. Celine Dion did not come to Adelaide, and I was very pissed, because it was like that was one of my 18-hour driving things to go and see her when she's in Australia. I saw her on New Year's Eve, actually, in Vegas, and was fantastic. But you have to see her at home. Like, I wanted to see her in my home country, and they don't come here often enough. So a lot of people, they bypass Adelaide. They go to Perth, they go to Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, and then they miss Adelaide altogether. Don't know why.
Sting used to have a reputation when he was, I guess when he's first doing his solo stuff, of like touring, like Akron, Ohio. And, I went to a college in the Western Ohio, and someone told me on the program board, somebody told the story, like Sting played here and then he went and did some other cities, and he's like, well, we're going back that way to play Detroit. Maybe we should stop in Oxford, Ohio again. And we had Thanksgiving. So like, he's English, didn't think ahead. Oh, that's Thanksgiving weekend. I think had his people call up the university and whoever they got. Was like, yeah, there's no one here. Sorry. Otherwise we do it, Sting. You know, think of it next time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He lives in the US, doesn't he?
I'm sure he lives in LA.
Oh, is this back? This is back when he started out solo stuff, right?
Yeah, I think I'm thinking about the time when he was starting to put cowboy hats on and stuff.
Okay.
A little bit less of my, stuff that I like from him, but
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's despite the kind of the dentist office music and the cowboy hat, I'll forgive him for that, cuz he was great in Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, the first Guy Ritchie film where he plays just like this, bartender who doesn't give a shit, and he's not going to be bullied by the local gangster. Small role, but he was great in it. So
yeah,
it was so good for me. So
yeah, I've got, I've actually, I prefer him from the Police, but my dad was a big Police fan. So I've got all the LPs and awesome. Stuff like that. Yeah. I can't say he left them to me. He didn't leave anything to anybody, but when he passed away, I just took over all of his record collection, and there's a lot of the Police. It was his favorite, absolute favorite when he was at school. So it just rubbed off. And that's my thing. Like, I listen to a radio station that plays 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s music. And they've just recently, I just figured this out the other day. I was listening to the station and they've started putting some 90s stuff in. But the 90s stuff that they're, this station is called Classic Hits. I'm not ready for Britney Spears to be classic.
Then you feel old.
Yeah, I'm just not ready for that just yet. But, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, I love that. That's what I grew up listening to. So that's what I prefer to listen to now. And a lot of the stuff that we hear on the radio is a repetition of something that we've heard before, or a mix with a sample of something that's come from the 60s or 70s. And they did it better back then anyway. So that's what I prefer.
Yeah we all have our taste, you know.
Yeah. So people can find your book. The website is 90 Days in the 90s, but it's 90daysinthe90s.com. The book cover, I see it behind you there, says 90. It's the word 90 on the book cover. I'm pretty sure I saw that.
Yeah, so the official title is 90 Days in the 90s, and it's so the words 90 Days
in the 90s. Yeah.
It's amazing. You just type it in backwards and... you know, the good part about having it on Amazon is that, you know, you can get a copy in Australia or New Zealand or wherever. And, you know, it's, I guess.
Yeah, that's where I bought mine.
You won't have to put it on a plane to the U.S. as the shipping costs is a lot less. And also, Amazon is, you know, I poke fun at Jeff Bezos' cowboy hat, speaking of cowboy hats, too. And we all be critical of Amazon. It does help with the SEO. I mean, once your book is on Amazon, there's no way you can not find it. So,
yeah.
You know, interested in reading it, you know, just you order it off Amazon and probably be there, be at your place in 2 days.
If you're in Australia, just get the ebook. Like, don't be buying stuff physically. Like, I mean, if you really want to, you can. But I had a book posted to me from Lexington in Kentucky. Now it took about 2 months to get here. Wow. Took about 2 months to get here. It cost $31 just for the postage. Excuse me. What is that about? Like $31 for postage and it took 2 months to get here. It used to take 5 days and would cost me no more than $10 or $15. Like, seriously, just buy the ebook.
I had a friend who actually was one of the first people to buy my book. And then when I went to the post office, she lives in New Zealand. They're like, okay, you got to fill the customs form and it's going to be $70 to ship it. And
ridiculous.
I just kind of said, okay, I message her and get a refund. I'm like, I'm sorry, I'd love to send you a signed copy, but like, me $70 is going to take 2 months to get to you. So when she actually contacted me last week, she's like, oh, my friend from New York City is going to visit me in about 3 weeks. Can you send her your book and sign it for me? So I sent one off to New York, and hopefully the USPS doesn't screw that up. And my friend Lady Trample.
Hopefully that didn't cost $70. Jeez.
Yeah, just $350 to send it to New York, and Samara will get it in, I guess, a couple weeks when her friend shows up. But I mean, sometimes that's how it's going to be. It's easy to put on luggage with a person, you know, or in a backpack and to use a postal service. But Amazon, it's there for a reason. So
it is on Amazon. That's where I bought mine. But if people in Australia are listening, I do have quite a few listeners in Australia. If you're listening, you want to check out the book. It's on Booktopia as well, which is our Australian book place to go to. It is available as a paperback, so you won't have to pay $30 for postage. But Amazon, I think, is it a Kindle version? Is it just a Kindle? It is a Kindle version. Yeah, so I think that was.
It's old school, I guess. And
yeah,
I don't know.
I love a good book. I love having a physical book. And I really do. But at the same, like, I have 13 books right now that I'm trying to sort of make sense of and not go too crazy reading. Just helps to have it as an ebook.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I could put my laptop on top of it and raise it up a little.
It took me a while to get over ebooks and Kindles kind of felt like an internet girlfriend to me for a while. I'm talking about a couple of years. I think a friend of mine released a book, and the easiest way to get it was on Kindle and on my phone. I finally had a phone that was decent enough to read it, and yeah, I get it now. So
yeah, you
know, it's trying new things.
I didn't want to either in the beginning, but I like as time has gone on and I've realized that actually, you know, the cost of having books sent, and I'm also wanting to be a little bit environmentally conscious, you know, trying to reduce my footprint a little bit. It just makes sense to have the ebook, but it is there. It's on Booktopia. I've put the link in the show notes if you're listening and you want to have a look. Where can people find you, Andy?
Well, you find me on Twitter at @sportyfry. It's Fry with an E at the end. I'm probably tweeting about the 90s or making fun of millennials' taste in music or putting some of my sports articles out there. Because now I've been interviewing some tennis players and a lot of, kind of up and coming athletes. And that's fun, too. So, you got a good joke for me, tweet it to me and maybe I'll laugh.
I'll follow you. I like following.
Not that short.
Yeah, for sure.
So
what is it again? Sporty Fry?
At Sporty Fry with an E at the end.
With an E at the end. That's on Twitter. Yep. 90daysinthe90s.com with a 90 at the beginning. So 90daysinthe90.
We'll figure it out.
Is the book. Andy, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much for joining us. I've loved hearing about the book. I'm looking forward to reading it.
Well, thanks,
Jesse. I'm going to get into it.
Appreciate you having me on.
It's been great. Thanks, Andy. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next time.